went to the Forbes 500 list, 500 richest people in the world. A lot of them are Facebook and Oracle and Microsoft and Google. I'm not smart enough to create anything like that. A lot of people were oil, gas, or inherited their wealth. Warren Buffett, the stock market. I'm like, okay, those are all out. But there's this common, you know, denominator of people that were wealthy in real estate.
What's up, fighters? We've got another guest today, my guy, Charlie. Charlie, we're going to get into it, deep into it. But before we start, could you give them a background on who Charlie Hartage is and what you do?
Man, Ollie, first off, I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much for having me. Love talking about military, love talking about real estate. My passion is real estate, not military, but, you know, I still love the country and all that. I live in Nashville, Tennessee. I was in the military. I was in the Army. I was enlisted. I was in the Army for about 5 years. Got shot. I'm medically retired, and I went back to the corporate world doing IT sales. Over the last 3 or 4 years or so, just done a deep dive on real estate. I am a multifamily syndicator, and I love helping people achieve financial freedom.
I love it. I love it. Now, I know Charlie brushed over the getting shot thing like it's no big deal. He's an infantry guy. That's how it works. You know, but we'll get into that. But before we do, Charlie, let's talk a little bit about all the things you've been through. You talked about, like, a second ago, you got shot, and we'll talk about that in a bit. But you've been deployed twice. You're now in real estate investing. You have been in the infantry. You've done a whole lot. Let's dive in a little bit into the military life, the military background. What was it like being an infantry officer from, and let's talk from the jump, because technically we don't really go through basic training per se, but we have our own little weird version. But I know for you guys as infantry, it's more of a rough and tumble kind of organization, some rough and tumble kind of culture, right? So what does that look like as far as your career starting into infantry, and what was your thought process going into that?
Man, so this is funny because I had a degree, and okay, I was working in a corporate world, sitting at a desk, selling computers and software. I was 19 when, or I'm sorry, I was 17 when 9/11 happened, so I couldn't sign up then. I was told to go to school, right? Get a degree. Right. Went that route. After my degree, I went and sold computers. Still was wanting to get into the military, so I did what every dumb infantry guy did, and I did it the wrong way. Instead of going officer, I went enlisted, right? Okay. So I went enlisted with my college degree. Okay. I was an E4, which I got so much crap from that because I didn't earn my specialist. And you know, I had a blast. What I didn't realize is the infantry, Fort Bragg, is not great at paperwork. And so I did not get my OCS packet in time because I was going to turn 30 on my second deployment. So I could not go the OCS route. Right. So sitting in Afghanistan, you know, you got that super high speed, internet over there. That's a joke. You know, you got the internet, and I was on the phone with different colleges trying to get into their ROTC program because I couldn't go OCS. So I was putting my paperwork in for green to gold, and a nice gentleman, a nice Afghani local police decided to shoot me as in my military career. So
good grief,
man. You know, I left the corporate world, to join the Army. I wanted to have some fun, or I say fun, but I wanted to have some fun, do one deployment, enlisted infantry. And then my goal was to go the officer route, because we all know officers have it pretty cushy, right? So
yeah, supposedly.
I'm joking. But you know, I wanted to go the officer route and wanted to do intel. You know, I that was my goal, my long-term goal. And unfortunately, because I got shot and I was injured, I got medically retired, and so I had to go back to the corporate world.
Right. So, all right. So with that said, and I apologize because I said officer twice.
It's okay.
You know, infantry soldier, which, you know, it is what it is. But Let me ask this. What was the second time you deployed and you got shot? Let's give me that story. Talk a little bit more about that story and what was going through your mind when it happened, before it happened, and then what went through your mind after it happened.
Yeah, and to provide some context, the first deployment, I mean, we were getting ambushed in firefights, probably over 100 firefights. Jeez. In, I don't know, 3 or 4 months. Right. Richard Engel from NBC News actually came out and filmed us and during a firefight. He was already there, but a firefight broke out and he filmed that and it was on the news. So first deployment, pretty insane. Lots of firefights, lots of people hurt or worse. Second deployment, we thought it was going to be just as bad, if not worse. Man, it was pretty chill. No firefights for the entire time we were there, actually. And wow. The interesting piece of that, it was, you know, all we were doing was guard duty. We only had electricity at night. Not too much going on for that that AO. Right. And what we were doing is we were building a local police checkpoint for the Afghan local police, who, you know, by day were our friends and we paid them, and by night were with the Taliban. And when we around that time too, there's a lot of guys who had fought the Russians back in the day that were getting murdered by those local policemen because, you know, they wanted the power and wanted to get rid of those, you know, guys who loved Afghanistan.
Right.
So fast forward, I mean, we were building the local police station. Myself and one of my buddies went and had to do pull overwatch on a river, and two Afghan local police went over there, and I got shot. AK-47 about 10 feet away, 3 meters away. The guy was, you know, pretty close to the two guys were close to us, and he shot me. I fell backwards. And I told my buddy, I said, kick me the radio, because I was the team leader. So right. I called it up. But my buddy was another team leader who to this day is my best friend. He was calling on the radio at the same time. So we were stepping on each other. That happened two times. The third time, he's like, Chuck, what happened? I said, send Doc. So they came over. They're only about 150 meters away. So it only took them a minute or so. They ran over. Man, Ollie, I promise you, I fell back. And instantly, there's no pain. When I fell back, I was like, I'm alive. My wife was 7.5 months pregnant. Oh. So my buddy, my best friend Ortiz, he came over, he was holding my hand. He knew about, my unborn daughter at the time. She's now 10. She's absolutely amazing. Nice. He knew my wife very well. And he's like, you know, you're going to get to go home. You're going to go get to be with Sadie, my daughter.
Right.
And I was like, man, I knew for some reason, I just knew I was going to be alive. I knew because I wasn't dead immediately. Now I could have bled out on the bird, you know, flying into Kandahar airfield, but I knew I was going to be alive. And he was holding my hand and we were just talking. I'm a big baseball fan and he likes rival teams. So he was giving me crap about that. And, you know, so it was just kind of a conversation. And the funny part, I tell my 10-year-old this all the time, man, the piece of it that bugged me the most was when they rolled me on my side and there's this long blade of grass that kept poking me in the eye. And I kept blowing at it, like, get away. And it kept hitting me.
Right.
But I mean, at that point I knew I was going home. You know, I didn't know the road ahead. I had no idea. I suffer from PTSD. I have really only admitted that about 9 months ago. I mean, this happened 11 years ago. And I just recently admitted that I have PTSD, and, you know, part of, you know, I think I'm semi-successful in real estate. I'm smart, but people can still suffer from PTSD. It doesn't matter what you look like, who you are, what your background is. Absolutely. And so, you know, thanks for, you know, giving me this platform to not talk about myself, but talk about PTSD, because my first deployment, going back to how rough it was, we've probably had as many people. We had 7 to 10 guys that were KIA. We've had about that many that have taken their own life in about 12 years. And it doesn't have to be that way. So I thank God I'm alive. I love talking real estate, love talking military, but you know, I definitely want to get the word out that you know, you don't have to go, you don't have to get shot to suffer from PTSD, right? At all. Doesn't make you more or less of a person because you have PTSD. You belong. So that's my soapbox. Yeah, man, I you know, it was a long road from physically recovering. Had a man, I don't know, dozens and dozens of doctor's appointments. My super pregnant wife at the time, and then my non-pregnant wife with my newborn baby went to most of those appointments with me. And so it was awesome to be able to be with my wife all the time, because I was, you know, I wasn't going to formations and all that. My duty station was on my doctor's appointments and just getting better. Took a long time, took probably a year before I felt, you know, good,
Truly comfortable,
even
right?
just like jogging or a fast walk. You know, it went in my neck, and went out my back, just right next to my spine. So I'm missing a big piece of my back still, and never going to get that back. My daughter calls it my snack holder. So I've never put snacks in there. I wouldn't trust it, but you know, she can if she wants.
What's wrong? What's wrong with kids, man? Why are they like
Know.
this? What's going
Man,
on?
she's awesome. It's now
That's
it's a big
hilarious.
joke, but at first it's like, what are you talking about? But
Right, absolutely.
yeah.
All right, so you talked a little about PTSD, and I don't want to at all leave it to being light, because it's a very important topic that we
Yeah.
talk about, but we don't really get to hear really solid advice from those who've experienced it before. Now, everybody, I think most military members have some form of PTSD, a lot
Agree.
versus a little. But
Yeah.
you know, like things like you can't sit with your back to the door. Like I can't do that. It makes me uncomfortable sitting my back to the door. If a loud explosion happens, I will jump and look around. And if I'm not like everybody else jumping and just ducking down, I'm looking around trying to make sure I can run away to somewhere else. So I think it's different for everybody, of course. But for somebody who's been through it, particularly being shot in the neck, like that's a super traumatic injury. It's not like you got shot in the arm or the hand or the foot. This is the neck. Like this is as close to your head as you're gonna get without seriously putting you out forever.
Yeah.
What is your advice for those who are in the situation where they're in the fight, if you will, in a foxhole somewhere, sitting down right now, listening to us talk about real estate, as we're going to hear in a bit. But right now, they're listening to us talk about PTSD. What's your advice to that person?
Man, I think the best thing that anyone can do is just talk to someone about it. I think especially the infantry has this mentality of, you know, if you try to get help, you're not a man, or you're not strong, or you're weak, or whatever. And I mean, that's just not true, right? That's not true at all. It's okay to ask for help. If you're sick, what do you do? Do you take it on yourself, or do you go to a doctor? You go to a doctor, you go to a professional. If your mind is sick, if you have some type of, you know, PTSD or some type of traumatic exposure, it's okay to talk to someone about it. Maybe that is your spouse, your partner, your best friend, someone that was in the foxhole with you. Maybe it's a medical doctor, but the best thing anyone can do, Ali, is actually talk to someone about it, because if you hold it in, it's not going to get better. I'm not strong enough to beat this myself. And I think 9 months ago I admitted that, right? And maybe for years I said I didn't have it. And I think for a while I didn't think I actually had PTSD, but you know, over time I'm like, yes, I do have PTSD. I still sit, you know, with my back to or watching the door, right? I hate going into crowds. July 4th is you know, rough sometimes. Same thing with New Year's, just with all the fireworks. You hear a car backfire, you get down, right? You know, that stuff still hits me. It's not as bad as it was, you know, 5 years ago and 10 years ago, but it still happens. But the best thing you can do is talk to someone about it. That's at least a great place to start. Because if you hold it in, it's likely only going to get worse.
I love it. I appreciate that advice, man. I think that is very, very much important that people hear that, because they're like we said, there's somebody right now who's sitting in the foxhole who can't figure it out. And even for that matter, there's folks who are sitting in the worst place in the hood. They hear gunshots all the
Yeah.
time and they have a level of PTSD. It just is what it is. It can
Yep.
happen to anybody and everybody. So
Yeah.
for those of you who are out there listening, make sure you can go see your behavioral health specialist. on post. There's nothing weak. There's nothing sad. There's nothing to be ashamed of. It's something that you should do and you must do, not just for yourself, but for your family and for those that you consider that you love and that you want to be around for the rest of your life. It's very, very important. Yeah. I don't want to hear, you know, I hate the stories of folks coming back and taking their own life or coming back and abusing their spouse, male or female. It just turns into a dark, dark place. So make sure you go and seek that help. Now, with that said, let's transition, and maybe not as heavy. Let's transition into your movement to real estate. So you get back from deployment. You you get medically discharged. Get your words together. Yeah. You get medically discharged, right? How did you end up getting into the real estate realm? What happened there? What was that big transition with the light bulb, if you will?
Man, I read a book that no one's ever heard of, but Rich Dad Poor Dad, right? Read that on my
okay, the classics.
On my second the deployment. Classics. Yeah. Yep. Read that on my second deployment. You know, we were in the middle of nowhere, had my wife send me some other books, took about a month to get to me, read those, had her send some more. And so I was just so, and this is obviously before I got shot, I was just all about real estate at that point. All my, right. my free time, you know, besides missions and guard duty and eating was real estate. And so I learned as much as I could. And then I got shot a couple months later. So when I came back and I was just going to my doctor's appointments and, you know, changing newborn baby diapers and stuff like that.
Love it.
Man, I spent as much time as I could on real estate, reading books. I found Bigger Pockets later, you know, several months later, but just dove into podcasts and books. I don't even think I knew what a podcast was, which is funny. It was 2012. Yeah, just learn as much as I could. And I think when I started learning more and more about it, one of the big things I did, Ollie, was I went on, you know, how do people make money, right? Right. I went to the Forbes 500 list, 500 richest people in the world. A lot of them are Facebook and Oracle and Microsoft and Google. I'm not smart enough to create anything like that. A lot of people were oil, gas, or inherited their wealth, Warren Buffett, the stock market. I'm like, okay, those are all out. But there's this common, you know, denominator of people that were wealthy in real estate. I'm like, I can do that. So I started learning more about real estate, and man, there's just so many different niches out there, right? You could flip homes, you could wholesale, you could buy a single family, rent that out, whatever. And I just never felt like, man, I want to do, like, I'm going to do that because knowledge, experience, you know, a lot of that stuff, in my opinion, it's hard to have a partner. It's hard to make money with a partner on some of that stuff. But there's one thing called multifamily syndication that I had heard about, and you could passively invest and you get all these benefits. I'm like, obviously that's a scam because I hadn't heard about it on podcasts or anything else.
Right.
So I kept looking. A couple years later, I went back to multifamily syndication, and I'm like, oh man, okay, I'm smarter. My mindset had changed. Okay, I got to look into this because I'm 35 or whatever I was, not getting younger. I'm still in the same freaking position that I was when I was an E4 in Afghanistan of wanting to do something, but not knowing how or what to do.
Right.
So did more of a deep dive on the syndication space, found other people investing passively who loved it. I knew some people that were active on the active side. I invested with them. 3 days later, I'm not lying, 3 days later, after my first investment, they had another deal, and I wired money 3 days later. I was like, man, because I was so hooked. It Let's had go. This, man, it had this, you can passively invest and grow your wealth. I'm risk averse. So I'm like, I'm not an expert. I don't have the right. experience, the knowledge, any of that. So I can't do it myself, but when I could, I couldn't even flip a home by myself in my mind. I'm too risk averse. But when I found other experts doing this as GPs, I don't have to be the expert. I can be a limited partner, a passive investor, have my money work for me instead of me working for my money. Man, at that point, I was so hooked that I wanted to do this full time eventually, right? But right. Yeah, so I about 9 months later, I got into my first deal as an active general partner. Wow. And now I'm on a mission to help anyone and everyone feel that same, you know, impact that being able to passively invest in real estate had on me. Right. I want to shout it from the rooftops.
I love it. I love it. It's amazing that you went through that, the process that you went through. And don't get me wrong, there's a lot of people who read Rich Dad Poor Dad. For those who are listening and watching, I'll add that Rich Dad Poor Dad. I'll add the link to that book here in the show notes. And let me write that down when I'm speaking. But it's just the fact that you did that and you acknowledge the fact that you were risk averse. This is one thing that I've realized that people don't really pay attention to. We don't acknowledge that we're risk averse sometimes. How did you have the ability to have that self-awareness? Because clearly you didn't have that forever. How did you develop that self-awareness to be aware of that?
I'll quickly try to tell this story. Long story short, I was putting an application in for grad school. The last thing was a 60-second video interview. They ask you a question. I have no idea what the question could be. It would have been 100 different, 100 or 1,000 different questions. Mm-hmm. And they would ask me one question. I'd have 60 seconds to think about it, 60 seconds to answer it. So me being risk averse and very analytical, I have to be super, super plan, I have to plan ahead. I spent hours, man, before that. That was the last thing I had to do for this, for application. And clear as day, I thought to myself, what's my biggest weakness? Mm-hmm. And I haven't been able, I'm far from perfect, but I don't make big mistakes because I don't take these risks. So I'm not able to learn from that. And man, I promise you, that was my question. What's your biggest weakness? And so when I got that question, I started laughing and then I gave my answer. I've already graduated from grad school, but that, forced me to be self-aware. And I was able to think through that. And then, about 3 months later, 6 months later, that's when I invested in 2 deals within 3 days, because wow. I knew I wasn't going to be able to do it by myself. I needed to rely on people with experience.
I love it. That's something that I've learned. Cause and you and I'll sure we'll talk about this later offline, but that's something that I've learned very quickly in the multifamily space, particularly in the multifamily space. Partnership is everything. You yes. can take down a 500 unit property as a brand newbie to real estate, to multifamily real estate. How do you do that? By finding somebody who's taken down 1,000 units, like a Charlie, like a Omar Khan, like a Bruce Frazier, like the, whoever you might find or you might run into. These are all people that I run into in my career so far. But whoever you might find, you might run into. I guarantee you take them a deal and say, hey, I've got this property I'm looking at in East Bumblefuck, Tennessee. They're going to 100%, I guarantee you, they're going to say, let's sit down and talk about those numbers, right? They'll even help you underwrite it. So that's awesome, man. That's really, really awesome. So how are you going about now investing now with how weird and wild the market is as it stands at the moment? How are you investing in multifamily as we speak?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we had gotten into, how many deals was it? 3 or 4 within about 18 months. I think it was within about a year we got into 4 properties. And that was before the interest rates went, crazy.
Nuts.
In the last year and a half since interest rates have gone up, we've gotten into 1 deal. We're closing on a, I think, 89 unit next week. And those two took a lot more time in underwriting. I say time in underwriting. They're no different than other deals, but we had to weed through hundreds of other deals, right? To find these deals. So that's, the deal flow has slowed way down. When there are deals, there's not necessarily deals. There's properties on the market. Doesn't mean they're a deal. So we've had to underwrite more.
That's a fact.
So man, it's been, our criteria hasn't really changed, but right. It's just been so fewer opportunities. Whereas year and a half ago, we were putting in 2 LOIs a month. Right. Now we've put in like 3 this year, I think. Wow. And we're recording in August. So, right. It's been quite a difference, but the fundamentals haven't changed. And it right. honestly, it has allowed me to do a lot more on the marketing end, social media, emails, and podcasts.
Now you talk about, there's a couple things I want to go over that you spoke about just now. One is if you talked about your criteria, what does your criteria look like? What does that look? And then why do you go for each?
Yeah, great question. First off, we look for growing markets, growing jobs and population growth. a lot of times those go hand in hand, but we want to make sure that it's a good market. Want to make sure that it's landlord business friendly state and city, because those are not always the same. Want to make sure that there's some type of housing shortage, that there's good jobs, multiple diverse economies. So we're not focused on, you know, a place where it's only IT or only oil and gas. We want a lot of different things, because if oil and gas takes a big hit, that's okay. We still have, you know, seven or eight other large economies and jobs in this area. So right now, I mean, you know, I'm in Nashville, and I think Nashville's a great place to live, low cost of living, tons of businesses and headquarters are still moving to Nashville after all these years. There's no state income tax. Property tax is like a third what it is in Texas and some of these other states. So, you know, we like to buy value add deals in growing markets. And so value add can look like a lot of different things. There's operational value add. So, for example, we actually bought a property last year, and the one that we're closing on next week, that the one last year had a single family property management company with 44 units. You know, like single family versus multifamily property management companies, completely different. Can they do it? Yes. Can they do it well? Yeah, it no. Right. And so you got to make sure that, you know, you have vendors in that area as well, contractors, property management companies, you know, property management companies are huge. They're extremely helpful, or they can be a huge detriment. Right. And so you want to make sure that you know the market, your property manager knows not only the market, but your criteria and your business plan. Mm-hmm. The property in I won't say it, but that we're closing on next week, it was a developer bought it, fixed it up, and is self-managing it. So he's he's not an operator, he's a developer, but instead of operating it, he's self-managing it. So it's like, for us, I mean, we see that as a phenomenal value add, just operational piece. Both of those properties were renovated. We didn't have to do much renovations. But then from the renovation side, you know, one of the properties we drove in, trash all over the place, broken down cars, mold and mildew on the buildings, foggy windows. We've cleaned that up, so it looks, you know, like a legit place that people want to live. Right.
Right.
So there's a lot of different things that we look at. We have a pretty extensive due diligence and underwriting criteria. You know, we've been able to whittle a ton of properties down just because they don't fit our buy box anymore. Or I say anymore, they never fit the buy box, but we're able to eliminate them much quicker, you know, now versus when I first started and I'd underrate everything.
Now, you talk about the basics earlier. You mentioned the basics. What do you consider the basics when it comes to multifamily real estate?
You know, our criteria for our investors, we want to double their money in 5 years or less, or we want to buy a property, do a cash out refinance, get them their money back, and then it's an infinite hold. So those are the two strategies that we look at. You know, some investors are they're in different places in their journey. Maybe they don't have money. They want to build that money, want to build wealth, or maybe they already have it and they want to preserve it and grow it and get those phenomenal tax benefits. So we offer two types of investments for our investors. So I think that that's where we start. Like, hey, when we talk to investors, this is our criteria. If it doesn't fit in either one of those, I'm not the, you know, we're not the team for you.
I like it.
Then from there, we know, I probably spend too much time analyzing interest rates, knowing where they're going to go, or at least where experts think they're going to go, because I'm no expert by any means. But I talked to a lender, a broker, a mortgage broker many, many times, like pretty often, just figuring out where rates are. So we want to make sure that the interest rates, the bank terms are still favorable for us. And those have changed so much over the last 12 months. I mean, heck, even 6 months they've changed. Mm-hmm. And so what worked today doesn't work necessarily in a month from now. So we just want to make sure that the stuff that we can't really control is controlled as much as possible, and we're staying on top of that. And then as far as the properties, we look for typically for properties that are 80 units and above. Okay. not all the time, like that 44 unit, that was just such a great deal. We couldn't pass that up in a phenomenal market in San Antonio, which is growing like crazy.
Oh, yeah. That's
but typically, market. Yeah, right next to the Air Force Base. That's
oh, man.
But,
yeah, that's gold right there. Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Smokes. That's
yeah. And love my Air Force friends as well. Not as much as Army, but that's another topic. No, I'm joking. But, you know. We want to make sure that we're in places with steady employment, where we're on top of the interest rates, where we know that you know what when we underwrite that what we're doing is still conservative. That even if they go up, we're still pretty accurate because we underwrite so conservatively. Yeah. 80 units and above, where we can just add value, whether that's operational or doing some renovations.
I like it. No, that makes perfect sense. The fact that you have, one, laid out the basics. Two, you guys have also laid out your criteria, and you have, you know, everybody has a certain criteria they'd like to adhere to and stick to. I'll give you one that we do, that I look at specifically, is anything that was built before 1970, I'm not that much a fan of. Like, it's got to be a good deal. And the reason is, for those who don't know, it's the cast iron piping inside of a property. That stuff is nuts. I've heard of guys squeezing the pipes. I've heard of the pipes just collapsing. And the amount that it costs to repair that or to replace that is phenomenal. So if you get into a property that has that and you're not looking at that prior to, make sure you look at, if it says anything before 1970, look and make sure they have the current piping, like the PVC, that plastic kind of piping, not the, I don't remember the technical term is, I'm not a construction guy, but I know what cast iron looks like, and it's not pretty. I can tell you that right now. Now, with that said, and before I hit you with the our go-to troop to task, I got one more question for you. Specifically with all the stuff you've done, and you talk about how impactful not just multifamily, but real estate is. If you were to give advice to somebody right now to start down this multifamily, good grief, I keep saying multifamily, start down this real estate wealth path, what would be your guidance to them right now on, all right, this is step one, because this, like we said, the market, the numbers are going up, deals aren't flying off the shelves like they were before. I'm sure you notice this. I feel like it's going to come around here soon. I don't know what date, but it's coming back the other way. It's just how it works. It swings one way, then swings the other. But before that, as they're in there right now, they're in the trenches right now, trying to figure out a multifamily property, trying to figure out a single family property, trying to get an Airbnb, whatever it is. What's your guidance to them right now?
Get started. Educate yourself. You know, work on your mindset. I read David Goggins' Can't Hurt Me, one of the best books I've ever read, about mindset. It is. You know, get started. And if you're still active duty, awesome. Thank you for your service. You know, buy a home, right? Don't rent. Don't rent, even though I love renters. Don't rent, buy a home. And then when you PCS, keep that home. Don't sell it, right? You have the VA loan. Keep buying properties. Keep stacking those properties. That's a good place to start. Education, this podcast. You know, just learn everything you can about it. Reach out to Ollie, reach out to me. I mean, I love talking about this stuff. I was in your shoes, you know, having no idea where to start, to now owning about 1,100 units, you know, in really only about 3 years. It can happen. I did it. You can do it.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I love that. And for those who are listening and watching, I will reference, we had a podcast, two or three episodes ago, and we had an interview and we talked deep about the VA loan. Matter of fact, we have a couple, and I'll link those as well. You'll see the card up here. We're on that side over there by Charlie. You'll see the card over there. So that will be where you need to look, and you'll be able to see that link. That little card will come up. So hit that, check that out. It's a lot of amazing information out there about the VA loan, and you can do some great things with it. You just have to be careful not to screw it up like I did. Now, neither here nor there. Sorry for the time. Now, with that said, Charlie, we are going to talk about the troop to task.
Hello, 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 hello.
Now, I'll explain that to those who are watching and those who are listening. A troop to task is you are going to, or Charlie is going to give you one thing you can do right now to move forward into whatever area of real estate you're in. He already gave you one, and that one was to just go. Now he's going to give you another one. What that might be, I don't know. He might tell you to go out and buy 20 pair of tube socks. I recommend you do it. He's already done this kind of thing, so he's got to be giving us good advice, right? So, with that said, Charlie, what is today's troop to task?
I don't know if I can top the 20 pairs of tube socks, but...
amazing, right? The next 20 pairs of tube socks.
Next best advice would be figure out what your long-term goals are and your long-term plan, because in real estate, there's so many different ways that you can build wealth. Some of that's passively, some of that's active, majority is active. Figure out what your long-term goals are. If you're married, if you have a family, you know, talk to your spouse, talk to your partner about that, talk to your kids if they're old enough. Because I don't want to say go out and flip a home, because you may be deployed or getting deployed, right? Or you may be listening to this while you're deployed. You're not going to be able to flip a home very well if you're not there. So figure out what it is that you want to do. If it's passive income, syndication space is phenomenal. If you are transitioning to guard or reserve and you have more time, maybe look at flipping homes. But figure out your long-term plan and then work backwards on how to get there.
Okay, there we go. Off mute. Now, that's great advice, man. It's interesting. Something I tell people all the time is there is a strategy in multifamily. There's a strategy in real estate for you. You can see where my mind's at right now. I've said multifamily 79 times. We'll talk about that after this. But there is a path for you. If you want fast money, I would not do multifamily. Multifamily is not a fast money game, right? That is not a fast money game. You're looking at wholesaling. You're looking at Airbnb maybe. You're talking about maybe a month versus 2 months versus flipping a house. The average time frame is about 6 months, and that's with a good GC, right? And, you know, you can do faster, you can do slower, but that takes time. Not off your first jump. Your first break, you're probably going to be more closer to 8 or 9 months because of, you know, newbie L's. It just is what it is. We all take them. So go check those out. Go look and reference. Like Charlie said, read some books, hit some YouTubes, subscribe to this channel. Shameless plug. Subscribe to Charlie's podcast as well. Go check that out. There's everything that you need is out there. You can do it. It is in you. Charlie, how do people get a hold of you and reach out to you if they'd like to?
Yeah, I am on LinkedIn and Facebook, Charlie Hartage. Our website is hkigllc.com. My podcast is actually about passively investing. Most of the guests have been apartment experts. Had one guy on there that had a wine and whiskey fund, which was super cool to talk to him about.
That's dope.
Yeah. Passive Investors Playbook is the name of my podcast.
I'm glad you plugged it. I didn't get to it, and that's my fault. I got to be a better host. I'm working on it, people. Passive Investing Playbook. It's a great podcast. You guys got to check it out. Obviously, it's got Charlie on it. How could it be bad? So remember, you are better than you were, but you're not half as good as you're going to be. Me and Charlie got some other stuff we're going to talk about. I'm probably going to have Charlie on for part two. He's already agreed to it, and he didn't know it. He's been coaxed into it, so he's going to be back on. But in the meantime, you guys take it easy. We will see you next time.